It was the fall of 1972. Most of you were alive then. After a lot of prayer and consultation with some men that I knew, I decided to apply to Dallas Theological Seminary. Once that application was received, they obviously knew that this Yankee needed all the help that he could get. So in great grace, they accepted me as a student. And I arrived in August of 1973, 45 years ago. Almost, I was trying to remember whether it was this weekend or next weekend to the date when I actually arrived here. But when I arrived, I had enough money saved up for 1 year's tuition, but no job. Comes time, fast forward to the middle of my second year, and it's time to, we're in the fall of 1974, it's time to register for the spring classes, and I still had no job, and I had $125 in my checking account. So I went to the financial advisor to figure out what we could do to help me prepare for the following semester. And he said, we can't do anything until you come up with at least $400. Well, I didn't have $400, I only had $125, and I knew, even as a Yankee, that that was short of what I really needed. So I went back to my dorm room, started to pray and think about what I needed to do, and actually got out my suitcase figuring, well, I don't know what else to do because I don't have the money, I have nowhere to get the money from, and so maybe it's time to go home. Maybe this is all the Lord had for me. Maybe it's time to make another decision. And what do I do? Well, that afternoon, I met with a couple that I knew from seminary, and he was in school, and he and his wife and I were friends, and I shared with him my dilemma. And so we prayed together. And the next day, he gives me a check for $250. So I did the math, you know, 250, 125. All I need is another 25 bucks. I got a check in the mail. I can't remember whether it was 25 or 50, but it was enough to cover the 400. And then I got a job washing dishes in the seminary cafeteria. You know, the best part about that job, which is totally unrelated to this story, was that the women who did most of the cooking down there felt sorry for us single seminary students. And so I got to bring home food every day. So I had more than enough, yes, which I shared generously with the rest of the guys in the dorm. But that whole process reminded me that life is about making decisions. And in the process of making those decisions, there's often a great deal of uncertainty. Because you don't know what the outcome is going to be. And often that's where we live. We're trying to make the best decisions that honor God and benefit our families. Seldom does God write on the wall, this is what you're supposed to do. Matter of fact, the only time God wrote on the wall, that was not a good message. So we walk by faith and we trust that as we make those decisions, that God will continue to guide our steps. And in a very real sense, that's where we find Ruth and Naomi. They are living their life during the time of the judges. There are very few good models to follow. As a matter of fact, if you've been following along in our series in the book of Judges, the judges themselves are full of flaws. Most everyone does what's right in their own eyes. Famines have come and gone. Family members have died. So what does one do? How would they know what to do? Can God really be trusted to care and provide for them? For me personally, one of the most fascinating aspects of the book of Ruth itself, besides the characters and the story, is that it took place during the time of the judges. And while for the most part, for the vast majority of people, as I mentioned, they did what was right in their own eyes, we find characters like Ruth and Naomi and Boaz, who are trying to choose what's right. And the emphasis, before we even get to Boaz, on Naomi and Ruth as women living in a culture that didn't honor women, trying to make decisions that honor God. And how do they do that? How do they know the decisions they're going to make and the ones they're making are the best decisions for them? By the way, did you ever stop to think about what attracted Ruth to want to accompany Naomi back to Bethlehem? I remember, you know, the great text that's in chapter 1, you know, where Naomi tells Ruth she might as well go back to her people, and Ruth makes the statement, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you, for where you go, I go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." Why would she do that? The text doesn't tell us. But I have to believe that there was something about the way that Naomi and Elimelech lived their lives, and their sons, Machlon and Chilion, lived their lives, and the words that they spoke, that attracted Ruth to want to follow Yahweh more than return home to her gods and her family. There was something about the way they lived and the attitudes they had and the words they spoke that Ruth, when it came time to make a decision about going home to a place that she knew, as opposed to accompanying Naomi to a city she'd never been to, that she chose Naomi in the city and a different people and a different culture, because there was something that attracted her to want to be a follower of Jehovah more than attracted her to want to return home. So Naomi and Ruth returned to Bethlehem. Well, at least Naomi returns to Bethlehem. As far as we know, Ruth had never been there. I mean, for her, it's a new city. It's a new people. It's a new culture. It's a new worship. It's new living arrangements. And we are in chapter 3 in the book of Ruth. But before we get to the actual text, I want to give a little background to a couple of ideas that become evident in the midst of chapter 3 and chapter 4. We're introduced to them in chapter 2 and verse 20, when Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he," speaking of Boaz, "be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative. He is our closest relative." Now, she's thinking that Boaz is the closest relative. We'll find out at the end of chapter 3 that there's another relative that's actually closer. And whether Naomi just forgot or was unaware of some of the lengths of her family tree, she didn't have Ancestry.com to do all that for her. But here is Boaz, our kinsman redeemer, our closest, our Goel, is the word that she uses. And so we're going to be introduced to that in just a minute. But before we look at that specifically, there's another theological concept that is implied in terms of what's going to happen in chapter 3. Because you know the story, and Naomi is going to ask Ruth to ask Boaz to marry her. Now, Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. Nowhere, and we'll see this as we look at this in a little bit, does it say that the responsibility of a kinsman redeemer is to marry the widow. That's over and above the responsibilities of the kinsman redeemer. He's a redeemer. He buys back. He brings the person or the property back into its rightful place. But Naomi's going to go beyond that. One of the implications is the concept, the Old Testament concept, of what's called Levirate marriage, which basically means that if in a family context, a brother is married to a woman and the brother dies, his brother is to take the woman as his wife and bear children so that the name of the family can be carried on and she can be cared for. We find it laid out for us basically in three different Old Testament texts, One is Genesis 38, the other is Deuteronomy 25, and the third one's here in Ruth chapter 3. Go back to Genesis 38 for a minute, because you need to see this story, because it does have a point to the story. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, and so don't take me down too many rabbit trails in this incredibly fascinating story in Genesis chapter 38, because Judah, in direct violation of God's commands, marries the daughter of a Canaanite. The Canaanite's name is Sua. The daughter's name is never given. But she bears three sons, Onan, and Silah. Marries Tamar. Okay, now you're going, okay, I've heard that name somewhere before. Okay. But the text tells us, verse 7 of Genesis 38, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. That is a very rare occurrence. And if you've read enough of the Old Testament and seen some of the kings of Israel and some of the judges and recognized the evil that they've done, and the Lord didn't take their life, you can only use your imagination to think about how evil must have been. And it was probably beyond that imagination. So the God just took him. So according to custom, Judah says to the second son, Onan, I want you to go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. Well, it's pretty clear what he's asking his son to do, right? Onan knew that the offspring would not be his own, so he went into his brother's wife and he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give her offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life also. Judah says to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my third son, Silah, grows up. I think she was pretty sure at that particular point that Judah was going to renege on that promise. She did go and live, but after considerable time, Sua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of the mourning was ended, Judah went up to the sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Harah, the Adullamite. And it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So Tamar concocts her own plan to have a son. She plays the part of a prostitute. Judah goes in to have a relationship with her. She becomes pregnant. She gives birth to twins, Perez, and what's the other guy's name? Zerah. Now, what I want you to say, and there's all sorts of things we could tell about this story, right? And wonder about what's going on. But here's the major point that I want you to see from this story. Long before the law that came to Moses that was given to the nation of Israel, because this is happening long before that, right? The custom, the understanding of the cultural situation was that if a brother died, his brother was responsible to bear children through the widow. It was the accepted custom and understanding of the day. Now, with that in mind, go to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Because when the law comes, God gives direction in reference to that same concept as to how that's to be lived out among the nation of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 to 10. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her to himself as wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. Okay, very clear, right? exactly what's supposed to happen. If a brother dies and leaves a widow with no sons, his brother is to go in to have a relationship with her so that when her firstborn son can bear the name of the family, and so that it will be continued, and she'll be cared for, and the name will be cared for. However, this obligation is not absolute. Notice verse 7, if a man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He's not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, this is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. That's a nice name you put on the doorpost of your house. I'm the one whose sandal got taken away. So while it's not absolute, there's great shame that comes to the brother who refuses to accept the responsibility of bearing children. What's significant here is the importance of the family name. The widow is entitled to motherhood to perpetuate the name of the family. And obviously, therefore, for her to be cared for. Because how were widows cared for in that time and culture? Family was their responsibility. There wasn't government welfare to care for them. It was the family who cared for the widows. And one of the ways that they were cared for was that the brother was to take care of the widow by helping her to bear children, specifically a son, so the name could continue. Now, some of you are thinking and going, how in the world does any of this apply to Ruth? Because Naomi had no other sons, and there were no surviving brothers. They had both died, right? And Naomi had actually said to Ruth, there's no sense you waiting around for me to get pregnant and bear another son, because you'll be too old by then, by the time he grows up, in order for you to have children. So what in the world does levirate marriage have to do with Ruth? Well, let me suggest, as you hold that in kind of a thought process as we get to chapter 3, that Ruth becomes an illustration of how levirate marriage is practiced, even though it's beyond the parameters of the law itself. The law lays out specific guidelines within a family for a brother to take care of a widow. There is no brother to take care of the widow. So who's going to take care of the widow? Well, as you extrapolate the principle, it's going to be the nearest kinsman. It just makes logical sense to take the idea, the big principle concept, and who's next? We might say, if we don't have a brother, do we have a cousin? And use it from that perspective. And while not identical to Genesis chapter 38, and certainly beyond the scope of Deuteronomy 25, the idea is applied in a broader sense. Because after all, Boaz becomes the closest relative, or the kinsman redeemer. So let's spend a couple of minutes looking at the concept of the kinsman redeemer. The word Goel means protector or redeemer. It's specifically related to family need. There are two major passages in the Pentateuch that give us a perspective. They're both in Leviticus 25. So, since we don't spend a lot of time in Leviticus, let's look at Leviticus. And we won't spend a lot of time, but we'll spend a few minutes. Leviticus chapter 25. So that you can see, again, the guidelines that the Lord is laying out to care for his people. Verse 25. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor that he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. Or, in case a man has no kinsman, but he so recovers his means as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the years since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and so return to his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of Jubilee. But at the Jubilee it shall revert, and he may return to his property. So the property becomes significant. And the point of the redeemer, the kinsman redeemer, was to buy back the property. So if Vic fell upon hard times and he had to sell his property in order to provide for his family, and Vic had a brother, then Vic's brother could say, I'm going to buy back the property so Vic can make a means to take care of his family. If he had no brother, and Vic was able to get himself back on his feet and had enough means to buy it back, then he could go to the owner, the one to whom he had sold it to, calculate the years of the difference, pay him for the field, and then it would then be his. If none of that happened, then in the year of Jubilee, it became Vic's family's property again. Now, how often did the year of Jubilee happen?
70.
Yeah, 48 years, 49 years. So this is, again, but if he lost the property in the 40th year, then it's only 8 years. You know, if he lost the property in the first year after Jubilee, then he's got to wait a long time, and he might not be around for Jubilee. But the family name would still be there, and so the property reverts back to the family. Lee.
What kind of property might be the subject of this? I mean, you're talking sandals, you're talking plows, what are you talking about?
Physical land property. Because the land was given to the tribes, and the tribes were divided up and given specific places to dwell, and they owned that. That was their land. You'll see this again in just a minute when you look at, when we broaden the text just a little bit. Yeah, Rob.
It seems like with the wrong person at the helm, this can become a mechanism to just siphon wealth from a wealthy brother to a ne'er-do-well. Oh, I'm out of things. I'm going to sell the land. Hey, brother, can you buy it back for me? And 2 years later, wash, rinse, repeat, on. And he's just sort of requiring his brother to keep sending money his way, just washing it through I sold the land to so-and-so. I'm sure in the history of Israel, that idea has occurred to somebody.
I'm sure it has.
How is that dealt with? Because clearly I don't think Scripture is saying, yeah, just go ahead and leech off your brother, it's cool.
Right. I think that's the same, that the illustration that comes to mind is the family that's in the New Testament where they said the money that we've dedicated to God, we're calling it Corban, it's God's, but they kept it for themselves so that they didn't have to take care of their family. Okay. And so, I mean, and Jesus comes down hard on that. In terms of if it's God's, it's God's. And what you'll see is it's designed to be God's because the land belongs to God who gave it to the nation of Israel. And so that's why the land becomes important, to keep it within the family. So yeah, so it's if it happens, then there's got to be a means to recognize that they've exceeded or certainly abused the guidelines that God has set down to care for his people. And I'm sure it's happened. That probably happens in similar fashions today in different ways than then. But it doesn't, the purpose of a kinsman redeemer doesn't just apply to land. It also applies to people. Look in verse 47. We're still in Genesis. It's still Genesis, Leviticus, chapter 25 and verse 47. If the means of a stranger or of a sojourner with you become sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendants of the stranger's family, then he shall have redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. So the responsibility of the kinsman redeemer goes beyond just buying back property. If you end up you've become so poor that you have to sell yourself into servitude to another individual, then your brother uncle, uncle son, you know, so it kind of gets stretched out to a family member, who has well enough, wealthy enough, can actually pay a redemption price for you and set you free. So the purpose of the Goel, the redeemer, is to buy back property and to redeem a person who has been sold into slavery. Why is this important to God? Look in verse 55, Leviticus 25. For the sons of Israel are my servants. They are my servants whom I redeemed, goeled, out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Because God has redeemed his people as their redeemer, he gives them character traits, if you will, that they are to apply to their relationships with their brothers and sisters in Christ. That's the way we would say it, to their fellow countrymen. And so because God is the redeemer, they have responsibilities to be a redeemer. David Atkinson, in his commentary on the book of Ruth, put it this way. These duties, the relational aspects and the price-paying aspects, because they have to be a family member and they have to pay the price, which are prescribed in the Old Testament laws, are only understandable from the background of the covenant which in which Israel, as a people, became Yahweh's own unique possession among whom he dwelt. The land was Yahweh's and was given to Israel through his saving intervention as the powerful Lord of history. Therefore, the land was not to be sold in perpetuity, but was rather to be redeemed. Yahweh has also redeemed the people of Israel out of Egypt, by which act they became his servants. Accordingly, an impoverished Israelite who had sold himself into slavery was to be redeemed by the Goel. It is evident, then, that the responsibilities and privileges of the Goel are derived from Yahweh's redemptive action in delivering Israel out of Egyptian bondage and by bringing her into the promised land. The relationship of Israelites to each other in terms of the Goel institution is grounded in their common covenant relationship with Yahweh. And I will walk among you and will be your God, and so you shall be my people. The point that he's making is that the responsibilities of the Goel stem from the covenant relationship that God has made with his people, both in reference to land that he's given them specifically and to being called his people because he's redeemed them and brought them out. So that all of the life of the nation of Israel was related to the covenant that God had made with them. And so there's a broader context, scripturally speaking, of this whole Goel thing, because God describes his covenant relationship with his people as being their redeemer. I listed some verses for you. Exodus chapter 6, verses 6 to 8. And Isaiah chapter 43 and verse 14 and 44 and verse 6 and Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 34 and Psalm chapter 19 and verse 14. You know that one because it's the end of the psalm where the psalmist said, the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. The psalmist knew that God was the redeemer. God himself declares, I am your redeemer in Exodus chapter 6 and Isaiah chapter 43 and 44. So this whole sense of God being the redeemer of his people and his kinsmen, because he says, I will dwell amongst you. You are my people. You now belong to me and I belong to you, reflects Yahweh's character on behalf of his people. And it doesn't take much of a leap, does it, for those of us who are New Testament Christians, to see Jesus Christ as our kinsman redeemer. He's our brother. The Word became what? Flesh and dwelt amongst us, according to the Gospel of John. And then the writer to the Hebrews says, he had to be made like us so that he could pay the price for our redemption. He's our brother, that is, he's related, he took on flesh and blood, and he had the capability to ultimately pay the price for our redemption, to buy us back, so that we are ultimately his. He became like us, paid the price of redemption for us, rose from the dead after that death on the cross, so that he could guarantee that the price he paid would last for eternity. And so Jesus Christ becomes our kinsman redeemer, and we are adopted into his family and become heirs of God, or as Paul says in Romans chapter 8, joint heirs, co-heirs with Christ. That is what Jesus Christ, the only Son of God, receives as an inheritance. We become joint heirs with him. We become part of that inheritance because of the redemption that Christ paid on our behalf. Okay, you tracking with me so far about the Levirate marriage and the Goel? Now we're going to go to Ruth. Okay? All that's background. Because we return to the book of Ruth in chapter 3, reminding ourselves that, again, Ruth has noted that Boaz, the field in which Ruth has gleaned, is a relative, a close relative. Chapter 3. Oops, I'm still in Leviticus. Hold on just a second. So Naomi, her mother-in-law, says to Ruth, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maid you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight." The word seek, she says, "I want to seek security for you." And it means that you'll be settled and secure in a home with a husband. That's what that sense of seek security for you means. Or, let me put it in a paraphrased version, since Boaz treated you kindly, and since he is a close relative, let's see if we can get him to marry you. That's in essence what she's saying, what Naomi is saying to her daughter-in-law. And here's how we're going to do this. This is verses 3-5. I want you to take a really good bath. Wash yourself. Anoint yourself. Put on your best clothes. That's, so far, we're good, right? Now go down to the field, to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and then you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he'll tell you what you should do. And she said to her, "All that you say, I will do." Ruth, here's what I need for you to do. Get all dressed up. One has to wonder what kind of clothes she actually had for her best clothes, since she was a widow who had come back to her a town that wasn't hers, and to Naomi, who was a widow, who must now be living with other relatives anyway. So maybe she just washed the clothes that she had, along with washing herself to look nice and put on some perfume, and then goes down to the field. You don't go down to the field to glean in your best clothes. Okay, so she goes down to the field, but don't let him know that you're there. And once he goes to sleep, and notice he goes to sleep after eating and drinking. You know what it's like to have a heavy meal? Think Thanksgiving, and so what do after Thanksgiving meal? Take a nap. So Boaz is going to go to sleep. Note where he lies down, and when he does that, I want you to go in and uncover his feet, and we'll look at that phrase in just a minute, and lie down next to him. And when he wakes up, he'll tell you what to do. One thing's clear, a lot is really unclear. It's clear that this is Naomi's way of trying to get Boaz to marry Ruth. That's what we know she's trying to do. It's not clear why in the world she's going about it in this fashion. The author doesn't tell us, doesn't give us any information as to the custom of the day, as to whether this is a new idea or whether this is an acceptable idea or whether it's been done before or not. And just where was Ruth to lie down? I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but in my little bit of research, the Hebrew was as ambiguous as the English in terms of what it means to uncover his feet. And what in the world would Boaz tell her when he woke up? Whatever Naomi's motive was, it's clear that this could lead to a less than reputable situation. Because the phrase, uncover his feet, sometimes is used as euphemism for genitals. So was she suggesting that Ruth uncover him from his feet up to his waist? Or was it less than that? And we really don't know. My inclination is to say it was less than that, that it was probably from his feet to his knees. It would be the cloak that would be covering his feet to keep them warm at night. It gets cool at night. He'd worked hard all day. And now he's laying down near the threshing floor. And she's to uncover his cloak or uncover his feet and lie down. Again, we don't know why Naomi picks this idea. The whole scenario caused one writer, as I was researching this text, to suggest that Naomi was doing what was right in her eyes. Ruth and Boaz were trying to do what was right in God's eyes. I'd like to suggest that Naomi was trying to make the very best decision in light of the cultural context and what she knew to take care of her daughter-in-law and to provide for her family. And so she either knew of this idea or really felt that this idea was going to work. Otherwise, why in the world would she tell Ruth to do it? And Ruth does exactly as her mother-in-law requested. Again, Ruth's act of obedience reflects her love for Naomi as well as her commitment to the ways of God. Because what in the world would Ruth know about any of this stuff? If it was culturally acceptable, if it was part of Jewish tradition and means of a way to make a proposal, that would be all new to Ruth. But because she was committed to Naomi and committed to God, she was willing to follow through. Seeing where Boaz had decided to sleep after a long day of work and a heavy meal, Ruth approaches quietly, uncovers his feet, and lies down. Boaz wakes up. Do you ever have the blankets come off at night when you're in bed and your feet get cold? So what do? You wake up. Boaz wakens, I think because his feet got cold, and sees a figure lying before him, and he's startled. Well, wouldn't you be? If you found someone else in bed with you besides your mate, or you went to bed by yourself and someone else is there, who are you? He asks. And notice Ruth's reply in verse 9, or he says to her, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. Sherwood's translation, I'm Ruth, will you marry me? I mean, she doesn't say it outright. In fact, she's less direct than that, and actually much more enticing, because the phrase, spread your skirt over me, could easily be translated, spread your wings over me, which is the same phrase that Boaz used in chapter 2 and verse 12, when he said, may the Lord reward your work, and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings, under whose skirt, same word, you have come to seek refuge. Boaz had said of Ruth that she had sought refuge under God's wings. Ruth says to Boaz, I'm now seeking refuge under your wings. Would you be my protector, my provider, in the same way that God has been my protector and provider? One other time that I'm aware of that phrase, under your wings, is used in the Old Testament, Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 8. The Lord is speaking about the nation of Israel, and he says, I passed by you and saw you, and behold, you are at the time for love. So I spread my skirt, my wings, and covered your nakedness. I also swore to you and entered into a covenant with you so that you became mine, declares the Lord God. So God says about the nation of Israel, I have covered you with my wings. I've covered you with my skirt and made a covenant so that you become mine. And you see this played out in a specific relationship, Ruth and Boaz, where Ruth comes to Boaz and said, would you do the same for me? Boaz has recognized that Ruth has done that in her relationship to God. He has spread his wings over her because she sought him for protection. And now she comes to Boaz to ask for her relationship. Her wording, her demeanor, her actions all lead Boaz to say, yes. He says, may you be blessed, verse 10 of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after younger men, whether poor or rich. The word kindness, and Rocky spoke about this, and we've done this before as well, is the Hebrew word hesed. Can be translated loyal love or covenant love. Your loyal love, your first act of loyal love, this act is greater than the first. We don't know exactly what the first was, but my suggestion is that her first act of covenant love was her willingness to commit herself to God. Your first act of kindness. She committed herself into the hands of the Lord. I'll go where you go, Naomi. I'll be your people, will be my people. Her last act of kindness, says Boaz, is greater in the sense that you didn't seek other men who are younger than me to marry. Implication, Boaz is a little bit older than her. Maybe closer to Naomi's age than Ruth's age. So Ruth, Boaz basically says, yes, and calls her. He says, my daughter, do not fear. I'll do whatever you ask. For all, verse 11, all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. It's noble character. You know where else that word is used? Halil. Proverbs 31:10. When it's speaking of the wife, the woman of noble character. Interestingly enough, it's also used in reference to Boaz. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of, NASB translates it, great wealth. Better to be translated, great character. A man of virtue. A man of wealth in the sense of not monetary wealth, although he had that, but character wealth. As such, Ruth, who is considered to be a woman of excellence, and Boaz is a man of excellence, then they're going to make a good pair. They're two of a kind, if you will. In a society where everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes, in a culture that was full of immorality and selfishness and idolatry and humanism, much like our own, here are at least two virtuous people who are living according to God's word. And God is going to honor that. There is, however, one other hurdle, says Boaz. I'm not the closest relative. There's one who's closer than me. And before we can follow through on this, we have to find out if he'll take his responsibility. Verse 11. I'm going to do whatever you ask. Now it's true, verse 12. I am a close relative. However, there's one closer than I. So remain this night, and when morning comes, if he'll redeem you, good, let him do so. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. Boaz wants Ruth to rest. Perhaps he's concerned about her safety should she go home in the middle of the night. I used to tell my daughters, nothing good happens after midnight. So be home before midnight. And in a similar sense, perhaps Boaz is concerned about Ruth's safety, so he says, spend the night here and get some rest and then go home. And we'll proceed with this, and I'll check in to the closest relative and find out what he wants to do. And when she wakes in the morning before she leaves, he loads her up with literally six of barley, is what the text says. It doesn't say what the measurement is. Doesn't say if it's an ephah, doesn't say if it's a homer, it doesn't say it's a seah. If you remember last week when Rocky was talking about the, which one was he doing? The ephah, and how much that weighed. And she was getting a portion of an ephah and figured it was going to weigh 50 pounds. And he loads her up with more than that. So we don't know what the six of barley is, but we know it's more because when she gets home and she tells Naomi what happened, lays out the story, she says in verse 17, "The six of barley he gave to me, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed." Remember when Naomi returned to Bethlehem? What did she say? "God has sent me out full and brought me back empty." Same word. The implication is that Naomi's time of emptiness is now over. Starting with physical provision and ultimately family provision. Naomi's final words to Ruth, wait. Now you have to wait. You've done everything that you can do. You've done everything that I've asked you to do, and now you have to wait. Don't you love that when God tells that to you? No. We've laid it all out, and you've made a decision, and now you have to wait to see what's going to happen. It's often the most difficult thing we do, particularly those of you who are doers by nature. Waiting is hard. But it was rest and security that Naomi desired for Ruth, and her plans seem to be working to perfection. I began this morning telling you a story about my second year of seminary and God's provision in the midst of that. But in the process of making those decisions, I knew that I could not be certain where those were going to go. There's a great deal of uncertainty in the midst of that, just like Naomi and Ruth. But they made the best decisions they could. And we, like Naomi and Ruth, and in reality many others who have come before us, often struggle in making those decisions that affect our lives. It's not easy to trust God. It's not easy to know what's best or what will honor God the most. So we're often left with the tension in the midst of making those decisions, but we still must make decisions. And what we discover, often in hindsight, is that God's grace and wisdom has used those decisions to provide for us and bring glory to Himself. So let me conclude with three applicational thoughts for you this morning, briefly. One, you can be godly and biblical in a corrupt culture. Ruth was, Boaz was, and I think to the best of her ability, Naomi was. After all, what did Jesus say in this high priestly prayer in John chapter 17? "Just as the Father sent me into the world, where am I sending you?" Into the world. And then he prays, "Father, that you would protect them from the evil." Not take them out of the world, but protect them in the world. So God must have a place for us to live out godly, biblical lives in the midst of a corrupt culture, because that's where he placed us. Two, to do so requires that we learn to think biblically. We need to be intentional about our thinking, asking ourselves, what are the biblical principles that apply in this situation? That's hard to do. I recognize that. That's why it takes intentionality. That's why it takes what are the biblical principles and have to think about it. And third, then, once we know them and put them into practice, it often takes time to see where the result is going to be, so we have to wait and trust God in the process. And He's our Redeemer, who's made a covenant relationship with us, and He'll keep it, so therefore He can be trusted. in the midst of making our decisions, ultimately we trust God to give direction and to lead and to take care of us.